This will be a memorable one, a keeper, a classic in the archives. And we're going to talk to Mr. William Tompkins about Hollywood. Hello, Bill. Welcome back.
Oh, it's a pleasure for me.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure to be talking about Hollywood. Wow.
Yeah.
I didn't know you were that interested.
Oh, yeah. Here, how's this? Try this on. It's a minute and a half. Here you go. This is kind of a salute to you.
Now where they say, let us be gay, I'm going Hollywood. I'm ballyhoo, things to you,
Bing Crosby.
I'm going Hollywood. With a sun-kissed baby, and I'm on my way. Here's my beret. I'm going Hollywood. Hey, let us be gay.
Okay.
Cool.
1933, Bing Crosby. I'm going Hollywood. How's that?
Beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah, great old days. The Hollywood in the 1930s. People don't understand what that had to have symbolized for the rest of America was like the end of the rainbow. I don't know. It was the dream factory. It was, there was so much in the Great Depression for people to go to the 10-cent movie or the 5-cent movie and be taken away from their grief and stress and all that. How was it, Bill? Tell us more. And then we're going to talk about your dad.
Okay, actually, this is going to be sort of fun because I'm going to hit it from a different, sort of a different viewpoint.
Okay.
But actually, we talked a little bit about my dad before, but I have to sort of ease your audience into this because you have to sort of understand how he got to be in Hollywood, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Dad was born in Indiana, and actually, he got a camera, and when he was in high school, he took all of the photographs of all the different graduates and the next year's graduates in the high school,
mm-hmm.
and so he got really good at doing this, and after high school, he was fortunate enough to get a position where he could represent a men's clothing store, where he would set up meetings in different states all over the country about these new men's suits.
Uh-huh.
And so he traveled particularly all around Western United States, all the different countries and cities. And so he ended up in Los Angeles, and he met a fellow there that was sort of a representative of one of the studio's managers. And making the story real short, he got a job in the photography department. In the old Metro,
MGM, Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, really?
Mayer, yeah. And he worked in the studio, and what he did was kind of interesting. He came up with a method for developing the films, which are the films that that go into the projector at the movies,
mm-hmm.
and they were having a lot of trouble with them because they would break. So he came up with a proposal of using a certain type of chemical,
mm-hmm.
and then changing the material in the film. And lo and behold, this ended up being a perfect answer to all of the breaks in the movie film.
So it would make it more pliable and not so brittle. It would make it flexible, and I get it. Yeah.
And the whole ball of wax.
Uh-huh.
So over a couple of years, there. It turned out that, of course, he did all of that MGM's films, but then producers of other movie companies actually got into wanting to use the same procedure.
Sure, all the studios would, I would think. Yeah.
So it ended up that every producer of a new film put in the contract a requirement that it had to utilize Tompkins' method of producing the film. So this led to the magnitude of films that were being produced. They simply couldn't produce it at that studio. So he borrowed a bunch of money, and he got a hold of an architect, and he built a very, very large laboratory right off of Santa Monica Boulevard in Hollywood. And this laboratory was enormous, and it was like a half a block long. And so he had all these people in that were developing the film, but he came up with another approach where he could convert the language from English into, say, French or Spanish or whatever, and he came up with a method of hiring men and women who could make this switch to the film, and instead of the old process of having to handle this blade with maybe two countries, he ended up making arrangements where they could sell the movie to 139 countries. And so this then, of course, just increased the money that the producers wanted, and it just became a fantastic operation. Because they were converting the language, and he then hired several hundred people, expanded the lab, and then was converting the language to all these other countries' language all over the planet. Well, that was a very profit-making operation. And so, obviously, he became a millionaire, and by the 1920s, he was extremely wealthy. And so, for a couple of years, everything went just unbelievable. And this part really gets interesting.
Here's August of 1922, I found an article from the American Cinematographer, August 1923, and the headline is, Nicholas and Tompkins Head New Owners of Hollywood Studios. And I could read some of that story if you, when you get to the point where you want me to. They bought the whole ball of wax.
I think it'd be appropriate, Jeff, to read that right now.
Okay, I'll do it. Yeah, this is terrific. And, I mean, when you think back, that this is 1923. Truly amazing. Let's see here. This is result 7 of 8 in the book for Tompkins Hollywood Studios Owner, which is interesting. All right, here's the story. Hollywood Studios, that's the name, one of the finest and most completely equipped motion picture studio properties in Southern California, has been purchased by a group of Los Angeles men headed by S.M. Tompkins and John M. Nicholas, founders of Standard Film Laboratories. Now, that's the laboratory that you heard Bill describe a few minutes ago. The announcement is made by Tompkins and Nikolaus following several weeks of negotiations. William Systrom, one of the best-known executives in the motion picture industry, will have charge of the studios under the new management and will continue to operate them as rental studios for independent producers of motion pictures. The purchase of Hollywood Studios by the group represented by Tompkins and Nikolaus involves property valued at more than $750,000. The studios are situated on a tract of approximately 12 acres with an entrance at 6642 Santa Monica Boulevard, Hollywood. The property is joined in the rear by the 7-acre tract owned by Standard Film Laboratories. That's the laboratories that we talked about earlier. The laboratories face Seward Avenue, one block north of Santa Monica Boulevard. Tompkins and Nikolaus announced that the organization buying the studios is entirely separate from the film laboratories that they owned. It is planned to combine the available space of both tracts of land for, that's about 18 acres, for the construction of large sets for companies producing pictures at these studios. So they're going to build backlot sets. In all, there will be more than 18 acres located at the industrial heart of Hollywood. The studio property has a frontage of 712 feet on Santa Monica Boulevard and of 387 feet on Seward Avenue. This does not include three residential lots at the southwest corner, blah, blah, blah. The new management of Hollywood Studios is made up of men widely known in the film industry. Systrom, S-I-S-T-R-O-M, who will be in complete executive charge, supervise construction of the Universal Studios at Fort Lee, New Jersey, and for 3 years was general manager at Universal City, California. It goes on a little bit more from that. Let me just pull ahead here so I can keep you up to date. It's jumping on me here. Hold on. Yeah. Well, I'm going to have to stop right there because it's doing funny things. But we got the gist of it all. Bill's dad and his partner bought 18 acres in the heart of Hollywood in this massive studio, which is primarily going to be used for independent film producers, right? And they were going to have everything in the world that they'd need for it. So just really an extraordinary story. Okay, Bill, take it away.
Okay. And things went very well for a couple of 3 years. And then my dad was asked to attend a meeting in New York, presumably to be with more financial people. For expansion of the laboratories.
Right.
And so at that time, the airlines weren't too good, so he took a passenger train to New York.
Mm-hmm.
And
they would have had trimotor, they would have had Ford trimotors back then. That was before DC-3s, even.
Yes, right.
Yeah.
So at one of the train stops, three men got on board. And my dad, of course, had sort of a room. They knocked on the door, and my dad opened the door, and the three men came in. And
into his compartment on the train.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm.
And so this didn't go very well. And essentially, he hadn't done what he was supposed to have done. And so he didn't get fired. Essentially, they had financially set everything up with their attorneys to where he was removed from the company.
How did this? How did a coup d'état like that happen? Who was the betrayer, the traitor in this that set this up?
Okay.
Your dad made this all happen. He was a visionary. He made Hollywood Studios reality in terms of his ownership and his company's ownership. He created a viable film industry by making the film flexible and durable so it wouldn't crack. I mean, S.M. Tompkins was one of the giants in the industry. But you'll notice that the name Tompkins is not a Jewish name. All right, now you have to understand that Hollywood is a Jewish enterprise. Nothing wrong with that. That's just the way it is. Read the book, How the Jews Invented Hollywood. If you're not a Jew in Hollywood, you're on the outside. So there's always that difficulty to deal with. Please go ahead, Bill.
Yeah, and that's, of course, part of the problem. But now, I've left something out of this story, and so I have to sort of insert it at this point. Okay? Now, I don't want to get on the bandwagon and start talking about other aspects of what's going on the planet. But there is a situation which is a little bit more complicated than most people are aware of.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is the Freemason organization. And it turns out that Dad was a 33-level Freemason.
Dad was. Okay.
Yeah. And so
so was my grandfather, by the way, if that helps.
Yeah, well, we got to talk about that later, too.
Yeah.
Okay, so what was taking place in this massive laboratory with all these people that convert the languages and get everything set up and send the movies out around the planet was something that appeared and I personally was not aware of it until many, many years later when I was staff to the vice president of GRW Space Systems in Redondo Beach. And at TRW, like we've said before, they essentially were an organization dedicated to the ability for United States and this planet to get the
go
capability
out.
To go extraterrestrial,
yeah.
Go out in the galaxy, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So they had hundreds and hundreds of separate laboratories essentially studying every subject that you want to come up with. And so whether they related to that or whether it was business, whether it was finance, virtually every subject they were studying. Sometimes they would have three separate laboratories studying the same subject, not knowing what the other three or the other two were doing.
Hmm.
All right, so they got into the study of the movie industry.
Hmm.
And what it turned out to be was that my dad's laboratory was involved with Freemason information. And so TRW then made the study, and they found out that there were the other things that my dad had come up with, and with the help of a lot of top people, that when you go to a movie store, to a movie theater, and with your family, and you watch a movie, and back then it would be Clark Gable and Jean Harlow in the movie. Okay, everybody that watches the movie, they enjoy this. When they come out afterwards, they talk about the movie, and they didn't know that something was on the screen which was presenting information to their conscious brain.
Even in the early 30s, they were using subliminals to program the audience.
Oh, my my gosh. Okay. So how much my dad at a 33 level Freemason, because now what you just found out is that that laboratory, those facilities were the largest promotional propaganda organization on the planet. Everybody gives the German credit for high propaganda because most of the German people had no idea what the German government was really doing. Okay?
Right.
And so now we've got something right in the United States here, which is a vehicle to essentially talk to anybody on the planet, because now we got 139 countries that are getting Clark Gable's movie. Except that whatever information the Freemasons wanted to get the audience to hear and control.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. And I mean, we're talking about control, mind control.
And your dad knew about this, obviously, and probably most of the insiders in Hollywood, the Freemason insiders and the Zionist insiders, they knew about it, too. If you can take... go ahead, Bill. Go on.
Well, only if you can accept that maybe because you got good Freemasons and you got some that are not so good, okay? George Washington, he put together the architecture and the planning for our city. That's the president lives in, and essentially every building in that country or in that city was structured and organized by the Freemasons. And so Washington, D.C., the entire layout of Washington, D.C. actually has one of the city streets covering 2 miles, and it's an owl. You can't see it from the ground, mm-hmm. but if you fly over it, you can see that it's a shape of an owl. Mm. And that's a whole different subject on the part of Freemason logos.
Right.
Okay, so now, I have a photograph, I have two photographs of the early laboratory, and the corner, it was taken from a corner. Right off of Santa Monica Boulevard, about half a block. And it has a Freemason logo, okay, on the corner, right on the corner. Now, for whatever reason, the other photograph taken at a different time, that logo's gone.
Hmm.
And what the actual circumstances were at the time that my dad got thrown out, I really don't know. All I can do is say what I found out getting involved in the study of Hollywood inside of TRW's secret laboratory years later.
Fascinating.
Because neither my brother or I, and I have a brother's 2 years older, Tom. Neither one of us ever knew that my dad was a 33 level Freemason, period. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And so my parents separated years later, and my dad's second wife, they lived in San Diego, and when he died, she called me, and she had all these things of dad's that she wanted to give to the son.
Yeah.
And so here's this ring. And it's not the largest ring, but it's the one that has the most hieroglyphics on it. Okay, so if you look up Freemason rings, and you can do that on the internet, there's hundreds of them.
Right.
Because there's thousands of different Freemasons all at different levels.
Uh-huh.
And the lower level Freemasons never know what the upper level is doing or how it's structured or anything above their secret level. And
it's like having a security clearance level. They all have different levels. How interesting. I got it.
Yes. Now, another point that's extremely interesting with the Freemasons is that not only do they have this separation, but a Freemason goes through different levels to get to the next level. It's called initiation.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And the upper levels of the initiation, my dad, I guess, corresponded to it, and so he never told his sons that he was in a 33-level Freemason. And, wow. All right, now, so we have to go back now to this great big laboratory in Hollywood, and Taylor W. Space Systems investigating Hollywood. And so when this information became obvious, it paralleled other studies of methods of control of people all over the planet. And so now we get into the TRW mind control program, and whoops, what was Dad doing way back then? Now, I have to say that I have to give my dad some leeway and accept that he probably didn't go along with this, the mind control part.
Right.
The situation where innocent, free people go to a movie and they watch the movie and they didn't know they were having their mind controlled. Wow. So we're talking about a little bit different picture of Hollywood. What you've just read about the laboratories
mm-hmm.
and the various details of him, those are extremely interesting. But what they were really doing is, quite frankly, like outer space. Who were the Freemasons, and what was their agenda? But now they have a propaganda organization worldwide into every country, and they have the ability to manufacture these movies, thousands of each movie, hundreds sometimes, thousands of each movie.
Hollywood, Bill, Hollywood was making between 600 and 700 feature films a year in the 30s.
Every one of these films were put into production with thousands, hundreds of thousands of copies of these. And all of them had some mind control information in it. Wow. What are we talking about here?
Worldwide mind control is what we're talking about. Were these flash frames, 30 frames a second or whatever? These are flash frame images, right, of text for the most part?
Yes.
What was the technique?
I have to say, I don't know the details of the technique,
mm-hmm.
but... for TRW to find this, years later now, because this is like 1965, 67,
right.
The TRW goes into this massive study of the movie industry and you say, well, what does that have to do with their mission, which is space? Well, maybe it's the number one tie. But it's a situation that gave, I have to say here a little bit about Freemasons, because obviously I've studied it like as much as I can. But essentially, it's not just that you don't know what the next level above you is doing. You have no idea of what the next level is doing if you're in the lower levels. You will never know in your entire life what the next level is actually, what's their mission.
Got it.
You're essentially told lies about everything above you. So you have no idea what's really going on. And you can be brought into this at the lower level to accomplish their agendas and never know what the real agenda is.
Well, got it.
It's a staggering situation, and it ricocheted off the walls of TRW, I can guarantee you.
Uh-huh.
Now, because here now is another facility with the capability of literally controlling every person on the planet.
And this was going on 30, 40 years before, and TRW found this and immediately jumped into it and probably discovered far more than they ever imagined. It's amazing.
That's correct. Yes, really, it's amazing what was taking place.
Now,
okay, now, go ahead.
No, I was just going to ask about the number. When you think about 600 to 700 feature films made, some were B movies, some were, A. These are sent all over the world with subtitles. A lot of times the actors actually learned some of the foreign languages and they read them phonetically. That was done. Some were dubbed. It's funny to see Laurel and Hardy, some of their films done in Spanish or German, which they actually learned and phonetically pronounced in these. You can find those online. So whether or not it was an audio insert into the mind of the observer of the film who was in some kind of a trance state, or they were text inserts like every 30th frame or something, it kind of doesn't matter because this was going on. I would suggest both were being used. This is a remarkable thing when you consider the worldwide ramifications of it.
Well, yes, and even finance is involved.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we talk about the enjoyment of watching movies, we don't realize that somebody's putting some information into our heads implement an agenda. Okay?
Yeah.
Now, this gets into the Bilderberger and the trilateral financial areas.
Okay.
Their control over the planet.
Yeah.
And it's another area that I really want to get together with you, Jeff, on. Because that's far more complicated than people realize, too.
Right.
So there's like a box full of capabilities to influence people on the planet that we really don't even know that these things are there and that they're being used all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not something that happens maybe once a year, but it's being implemented 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, every single year. And whatever agenda somebody wants, this is a method to present it and influence people in different countries. Actually, these are how wars are structured.
Hmm.
And I definitely want to get in with you on that.
Okay. We will. All right. What are your earliest memories? You talked to us about living in the apartment on the top floor of that building, which had been converted into four apartments. What do you remember about your dad's life when he was a multimillionaire and a big shot in Hollywood, a non-Jewish big shot, which made him very unusual? The non-Jews were weeded out early on in the industry, and then there were some hangers-on whose talent and brilliance, like your father's, they had to have. They had to have that film that wouldn't break. They had to have that film that was durable. So what do you remember as a little kid?
Well, okay, I think that's an interesting question, Jeff, because so not only did they take the company away from him, but they blackballed him, which meant he couldn't get a job.
Oh, my God. Oh, how sickening.
And now the levels of this get really complicated, but let's go back to when in the 30s, when the Depression was on. A lot of people didn't have any much money.
Right.
And but in our particular case, we lived in apartments, and we never lived longer than 2 months. One time we did make it to three, because we never paid the rent, and we didn't have the money.
Before this happened, though, Bill, do you remember as a little child having a home, a real home? Did your dad have a big home with your mom?
Yes, it was in Beverly Hills, Hollywood, someplace.
Uh-huh.
In those hills. And it was a very large home, and a lot of people were there, and there were parties, and all different groups were there. And so, like, my mom was sort of a debutante type thing. She was, like we mentioned before, she was a tall, blonde, blue-eyed lady with a beautiful figure.
Wait a minute. That didn't get past me. All right, okay. Go ahead. I'm on this train. All right.
All right, and in this apartment, going back to the small apartments where we didn't live there long enough to get to know anybody, because for several years we just moved from one apartment to another, from one town to another in Southern California.
I can't. Now this, Bill, I'm sorry, I've got to jump in here. Here's your dad, 33 degree Mason, bought out by the people who created most of Hollywood, forced out, a coup, made homeless, basically, penniless, blackballed from the industry. He helped, to a large degree, make the success that it was. This must have been, it must have made his friends enraged. And it must have been so hard on him that it probably shortened his life. I mean, I can't imagine going through something like that.
Well, I'm sure it did shorten his life. You have to get back down to, okay, what do you do now? And here's the strange part about this. We said he was a 33 level. But he's been blackballed. Okay, well, what was he blackballed? By the Freemasons, or how did that take place? I can't answer that question, except I can say this, that we're living in very small apartments in the poor area of Southern California, okay? And we hardly have enough money to eat.
My God, this is just a few years after. All right,
yeah.
I'm sorry. It's just
okay.
Making me very angry. Yeah.
Okay. And so he is driving a brand new expensive car. He wears brand new three-piece expensive business suits, expensive shoes, okay? He leaves the house before we even, every morning, before we even go to school, okay? He will sometimes not come home for 3 days or back to the apartment. And the automobiles continue to change from very expensive foreign sports car to Cadillacs, okay, to Lincolns. And we don't have money hardly to eat. And this goes on. So when I was selected to go into the Navy after the Los Angeles sightings.
The Battle of L.A., right.
Battle of L.A., they put me in the Navy, and instead of going right in, it was planned that I had to have a high security check. So instead of waiting a week for that to take place, it was like 2.5 months. So they put me to work in the Volte aircraft over in Downey, California, in 1942. And I worked there for 2.5 months while we were trying to get some sort of a justification of whether I was even an American citizen or not, because of all these places that we moved, and they had to be substantiated. All these addresses, hundreds of addresses, okay? And so it took them that long to finally figure out that, yes, I was an American. And so but I couldn't go into to boot camp even. I had to work in the Volte, but again, they put me into a secret program inside of Volte. I didn't work in the shop. I went into this secret Volte facility, which was designing inverted gull wing Navy attack aircraft that never did get in production, but they were trying to build it. But it was secret. It wasn't like confidential. It was a whole secret area. You had to sign in.
Right.
So I'm just saying that the level of security that they wanted me to be operating in after I got through boot camp was essentially above top secret. And so trying to go back then to what was Dad doing after all the money was gone, okay? We would, on Saturdays, he would be selling insurance, or he would be trying to sell real estate, or he'd be trying to sell money loans, all of which were just cover up for what he was doing with the Freemasons. And so he actually had two jobs. Now, he's broke, but somehow he's dealing with the highest level banks. And we had to sit out in the car while he goes into the different banks. And I would say at least 40% of a day when we, if it would be on a Saturday, and sometimes he even took us out of school, we would drive with him, and we'd go to Pasadena. And he would spend almost the whole day in the bank over there. He's not getting money from them, but he's getting enough money to from someplace to pay for the gas on these expensive automobiles. Then separate meetings, he would even take my mom and my brother and I with him, and we would go to Pasadena, and we would drive into the expensive neighborhood where these great big homes were. And we would go in there. Mom and Dad would talk to the owners. They let the two kids climb around the house, and I remember one big one, which had a second, it was the living area was three stories high to the ceiling, and along two of the corners up above were balconies going in to all these different rooms, and then the big curved stairway going up to those. So my brother and I would go upstairs, and we'd go through the different rooms up there, and my brother, being kind of dumb, he would climb up in the closets to see what's in the closets in these bedrooms, and of course knock all the stuff down, and then we'd come running out of the room to the edge and look back down to see if they heard it down below, and sometimes they did. I'm just saying, these are strange meetings, okay? We would go to back to Hollywood again, and we'd go to the San Fernando Valley side of the Hollywood Hill, where the Hollywood sign is. And we would go to an expensive home up the side of the hill that overlooked the whole valley. And it's only 4 or 5 blocks from different movie actors and actress homes all through this area, very expensive. And so we'd go in there, and my mom wouldn't be with us on that one. And the owner would greet my dad, and we'd go in, and they would fix breakfast for us. It was early in the morning, and before we finished breakfast, the two of them left, my dad and the owner, and they would be gone like till 2 in the morning. A couple of times, we were there all night long. So the wife was like, she was a movie actress, gorgeous, beautiful woman. And so we would go swimming with her in the pool during the day. And she would have lunches fixed for us and dinner fixed. And she would sort of entertain us. And sometimes Dad and the other fellow would come back like at 7 or 8 o'clock in the evening. And a couple of times it's like 2 and 3 in the morning when he comes back.
Wow.
So all these different, this goes on 7 days a week. Then he gets expensive offices in the business area in Long Beach. And now again, he's got another new car he's driving. And actually, there's meetings in San Diego. And all of us would drive down in 7-passenger expensive cars. I can't even remember what the name, there wasn't Cadillac, but it had jump seats, which my brother and I sat on in the back, which were on the back side of the front seats that fold down.
Wow.
And then there would be another great big seat behind that. So it's like a 7-passenger.
What a luxury car that was. Yeah, yeah.
And what is that all about?
We
come to San Diego. And then later on, he would drive to Reno, and we would go up to Reno. And then he would drive to Arizona, Phoenix, and we'd be there for a couple of days and come back. And one time we drove to Louisiana, and that was a 2-week thing, and we didn't have hardly money to eat on. And I'm just saying, my dad was still implementing Freemason agendas.
Something was big going on here. Hold on, Bill. We have to pause at the top of the hour here. We'll come back and pick up this remarkable story in just a few minutes with Mr. William Tompkins. So stay right there.